Greetings and welcome once again to Throttle Up, and a hearty welcome to all of you critical thinkers out there. Throttle Up is a radio show and soon-to-be podcast that showcases critical thinking and is designed to inform, delimit, empower, and amaze. Now, of course, inform is fairly easy to understand. It's to give us a bit better comprehension about how to view the world and what is going on and how should we deal with it from a cognitive standpoint. Also to delimit our thinking. We want to think outside the box. Inside the box thinking is no longer useful to us as humans, I don't believe. That's one of the basic tenets of this show. So we want to delimit our thinking, and we want to be able to think outside the box and come up with innovative ideas for ourselves, our families, our communities, and, of course, our country. We want to empower everyone. What that means, and that's pretty important. And I guess that's one of the things that we're trying to promote here on this show and some of the other things that we're doing in terms of videos and books and stuff like that. We want to empower everybody. We want everyone to realize that their power of reason is exceptional. And don't be afraid to use it. Don't allow it to be taken away from you by others who claim to know something that you don't know. That's all intellectual skullduggery. And let's call it the way it is. I call it intellectual nonsense. So we want to empower all of us to use our power of reason. And of course, the last thing is amaze. In you would be amazed. I know that sounds like I'm being a bit hyperbolic, but you'd be amazed at what critical thinking can do. Once we strengthen our power of reason through the employment of critical thinking, we can do incredible things. And I think that over the course of this show and other things that we do, we're trying to bring that out into the general consciousness of the country, where we can be amazed at really how powerful and how effective we can be. So, all aboard the Throttle Up Express, powered by high velocity reason. Now, I'm your host, Captain Kevin Smith, U.S. Navy retired. I'm a naval aviator and also a pioneer in the field of critical thinking and high velocity reason, as well as other related areas, which we get to from time to time. Our tagline is to accelerate beyond the ordinary, and our motto is to employ high-velocity reason to achieve high-octane performance. And we have a mission statement. Our mission statement is to provide our listening audience with a relatively easy, yet effective way to strengthen our power of reason through the employment of key aspects of critical thinking. Now, you could say that, and I often point this out, that the critical thinking model that we used for the show and that is explained in all of the books that I have published, I have 4 books in national distribution already, has been tested, field tested, if you will. So the critical thinking model that we use is operationally useful and has been field tested, has been tested in the field, or I guess a little bit more fancy way of saying that is that has been operationally tested. And it has. And so you can rest assured that when you learn about this critical thinking model, that you can use it right away. It doesn't have to be modified for anything in particular. It can be used right out of the box. But, of course, we're going to be thinking outside the box. So I guess I'm using a double metaphor there. But anyway, some of the things that I talk about many of the things I talk about is outside the box. Okay, the audio engineering services for the show is provided by Evergroove Studios, and they are located in beautiful Evergreen, Colorado, which is in the foothills outside of Denver. And the promotional material for not only for Throttle Up, but for other related things that we do is provided by Reflections Printing and Hero Marketing. And the principal there is a gal by the name of Jennifer. She also has a really interesting product line, if you will. I just took a look at it. She asked me to review it before she sent it out for the general public, and I did. I've been working with Jennifer for a long time, and she's great. And she has this product line called Standout Handouts, and it's really an interesting feature that she has going for her. It is something kind of unusual. I would call it a state of the art promotional, a set of promotional materials that she has put together over the course of many, many years of working in this business. And it really is quite good. So if anyone needs promotional material for whatever you're doing, whether it's electronic or whether it's physical material, I would highly recommend Jennifer. And her phone number for her organization called Reflections Printing is 435-574-0422. That's 435-574-0422. And she is located in St. George, Utah. You might give her a call. Also, her she has a website that is recommended if anyone wants to take a look at what she can do for your organization. Standout Handouts. It's www.standouthandouts.com. And you could spell it just the way it sounds, standouthandouts.com. Now, here's an idea. Now, it just occurred to me as I'm saying this, but I think this is a great idea. And more companies are getting or trying to get into the business or trying to reorganize themselves in terms of a solutions-based enterprise. We talked about this before on a number of shows, all right? So a lot more and more companies want to see themselves as providing solutions to customers instead of things. So it's no longer a Internet of Things. It's no longer a universe of things. I think things are now going by the wayside. Instead of things to sell, companies want to be able to offer and sell solutions to a set of customer problems. So solution-based organizations, if you want to get involved in that in one way or the other, I would highly recommend that you contact Jennifer and take a look at her Standout Handouts product line. I think you'd be quite pleased and amazed, and it could very, very easily move your organization into the next level. The next level being that it now is becoming or has become a solutions-based enterprise, and your job is to provide viable solutions to the customer's problems, all right? And the customers will love you for it. Trust me. If you in fact can do that legitimately and doing it with intent and integrity, customers will love you for it. I have done that myself on many occasions, and it works amazingly so. Okay, so all aboard the Throttle Up Express. This is the place where critical thinkers are welcome with open arms and where America finds solutions. Before I leave and move on to part one and discuss this show, and this show, by the way, is a special edition, but I'll get it to that in just a second because I'm getting a little ahead of myself, and I want to make sure that I get this out there. I've talked about this before, and I will talk about this again. This is really quite profound, which is that the 2016 Future of Jobs Report, published by the World Economic Forum, predicted that by the year 2020, critical thinking and complex problem solving will be the most in-demand set of skills in the global job market, but also the hardest to fill. All right, so typically the show is organized into three parts. Part one is critical thinking, continuing discussion of critical thinking. Part two is a storyboard, and part three is the radio essay. This happens to be a special edition of critical thinking, and it actually is part two of the thorough discussion of the Vietnam War experience that this nation found itself in somewhere in the late 60s and early 1970s, of which I was involved with. And so we wanted to get that series of special editions out into the marketplace of ideas, primarily because the National Security Advisor, Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster, wrote a book recently. The title of the book is Dereliction of Duty, and it was a rather interesting and thoughtful discussion of the Vietnam War from the perspective of the national leadership. And the reason, and that's the reason why we're doing this show and in the previous show, and maybe more, I'm not sure, because we have a lot of ground to cover. But I wanted to get this out because I do think that this is an important thing to discuss, not only because it gives us a window into the mind of the National Security Advisor currently in place in the Trump administration, and it also gives us a better understanding of exactly what happened, and why did it happen, and how did it happen. So not only what, but why and how are the things that we're going to cover. Okay, so that completes our introduction, and now let us press on to this special edition of Throttle Up. Okay, we are back, and welcome to this special edition of Throttle Up. And this is part two of our discussion of the Vietnam War, or more accurately, the Second Indochina War. And part one was the previous week and also the previous show. All right, so here we're going to be talking. The first thing I want to do is I want to summarize just very briefly what we covered in part one of the show. And then we'll press on to part two, which is the subject of this show. And we'll do an overview, and we'll talk about the timeline, and we'll talk about what happened, and then we'll talk about my involvement in this particular time that we call the Vietnam War. And I was on active duty in the United States Navy as a naval officer and naval aviator. And so my participation. So I guess what I'm saying is a lot of the stuff that I'll cover in the previous show and this show is firsthand knowledge. I was there. You could say I've been there, done that. I was on the ground floor of a lot of the things that happened as a result of the experience of Vietnam. And that pretty much followed my career through the course of my naval career after that. Okay, and this is a summary. So in part one, let me just summarize it very briefly. In part one, we discussed the geopolitical world situation and the rise and march of communism. So if we want to understand Vietnam, we first need to understand the rise and march of communism as a geopolitical force in the world. Why did it happen? How did it happen? And what can we do about it? So then, and after that, then we discuss why the United States decided to enter the Vietnam War, and more properly, this is known as the Second Indochina War. And just for review, the First Indochina War was lost by the French, and they had a stake in this region of Indochina, a colonial stake, but they lost the war, and so they withdrew their forces and their organizations and companies from most of Indochina. Okay, this is part two. So part two, let me talk a little bit about the overview. In part two, we'll start by saying that there's an old adage about warfare, and that is to win the war before the battle begins. That's what we all warriors know that, and this is what we strive to do. We strive to win the war before the battle begins. Now, with respect to the Vietnam War, this was not done, and a lot of other things were not done as well. So, in my discussions going forward, I will be a bit to the point. I don't want to be overly harsh by claiming that I know more than others or denigrating others' patriotism. This show doesn't intend to do that, all right? But I will speak and sometimes bluntly, because I don't want to be confused. I don't want to make this confusing. So with that in mind, let me continue. Vietnam was a war that should have never been. It was conceived of in an intellectual null zone, fought for reasons that made no sense, conducted in a hostile jungle environment that American forces were unprepared for, and fought with weapon systems that were not designed for this particular battle space. Militarily, American military forces performed superbly, albeit with unsuitable equipment. Strategically, Vietnam was an abject failure, due primarily to the lack of intellectual courage at the senior military level and unexpected and inexplicable deception by senior civilian leaders, including President Johnson. Now, a footnote here. All of you are encouraged to see McMaster's book called The Dereliction of Duty, because he points this out really quite well. At the end of this show, if we do have time, I will read an excerpt from his book, from the epilogue or the end of his book. It's really quite telling, and I think it's an extremely important thing to cover. So, continuing, because there were no articulated set of national level strategic objectives and no clear understanding of global geopolitics, the National Command Authority quickly degenerated into examination of minutiae in numbers. That is, the number of American troops, the number of enemy killed, the number of villages pacified, the number of warships deployed, so forth and so on. So it became nothing more than a numbers game. You cannot conduct war by the numbers. Thus, it became a waiting game, and all that the enemy needed to do was to wait long enough for the American people to tire of the war, and they would have won, which, of course, is exactly what they did. A small wonder. Now, let me move into the air campaign, or what we call air warfare. All right, so there was a massive effort in Vietnam to conduct air warfare. The air campaign included all of our air forces, the Air Force, the Navy, the Marine Corps, you name it, Army Air. But the air campaign was also a learning opportunity for America's air combat forces. And this will be the focus of this particular show, which is part two of the Vietnam War experience. Now, I will take a short break, and I will be back momentarily. Okay, welcome back to Throttle Up. And now this is a special edition of Throttle Up, and it is a discussion, part two, actually, of a discussion of the Vietnam War. So let me start off with this section by talking a little bit about myself and how I got involved in this thing. Now, in 1963, I was recruited out of college by the U.S. Navy and as an officer candidate and student naval aviator. Now, this was also the year, as you recall, that President Kennedy was tragically assassinated. Now, I remember the day vividly. I was a naval aviation officer candidate in aviation officer candidate school. And when I heard the news, I was really quite shocked. I didn't really know what to make of it. I was pretty upset, but I was also on active duty, a member of the armed forces, and so I was encouraged by my superiors to press on. President Kennedy would want us to do such a thing, to press on and to work hard every day to make America a safe place to live. Now, when I was in flight training, I was eventually selected for the supersonic pipeline. And of course, the only airplanes that fly supersonically are, and that's even true today, are the fighter aircraft. So I was selected for the supersonic pipeline. And after graduation from the Naval Air Academy and designation as a naval aviator, I joined the fighter community flying the FA Crusader. Now, this would prove to be important and a game changer for me because I would find myself eventually on the ground floor of the Top Gun movement. And I would eventually become the commander of the first deployed Top Gun unit in naval aviation history. All right, with that, having said that, let me talk about what happened. And I'm going to call this section Aviation in Crisis, or in particularly naval aviation. But the Air Force went through the same machinations and went through the same difficulties as naval aviation did. So I guess we could say this is a naval aviation in crisis. Up to about 1969, the air war in Vietnam, particularly the air-to-air combat forces, performed poorly. And this poor performance clearly indicated something was lacking. But what? What was, in fact, seriously wrong? Consequently, studies were done. Reports were submitted and programs were considered. People were either promoted or fired, but what exactly was the problem? And that's the great question here. And for all of us critical thinkers, that's a great question. In other words, always do that, you know, and that's one of the things that I discovered after getting involved in this thing. And I kept with it through the rest of my life. And it was very, very beneficial. And don't assume that people know what the problem is. Always ask that question. You get involved in something, it says, okay, exactly what is the problem for which we are seeking a solution? And a lot of people will come up and propose a solution within the context of describing the problem. And that, of course, violates Principle 101 of critical thinking. And so don't allow that to happen. Don't do that yourself. And don't allow that to occur in others. Now, you may not be totally popular when you do that, all right? But if you are, in fact, going to solve a problem and not have to deal with silly egos, it is a great thing to do. So what was the problem? The problem turned out, I know, this is really hard to believe, but bear with me here, okay? Let's go through this together. All right, so what was the problem? Number one, we had the wrong airborne equipment. Number two, we were fighting the wrong air war for the equipment that we had. It was operated by the wrong people. And when I say that with caution. I don't mean the people were bad. In fact, in many cases, the people performed extraordinarily. I know everyone that I know and everyone that I knew in the naval aviation community performed exquisitely. Just amazing group of professionals. I don't fault their performance. When I say the wrong people, I mean many of us, including myself, many of us were untrained for the situation that we had to encounter. It was also maintained by the wrong maintainability system. It was managed by the wrong senior administrators, and it was led by the wrong leaders. In other words, everything was wrong. Now, you can't make this stuff up. If you actually went intentionally trying to lose, you could not have done a better job. But here, and this is important, I wish to preserve the honor and dignity of the actual combat soldier, sailor, and airman, who, in spite of poorly designed and maintained equipment and wholly unable, or I could say more accurately, wholly inadequate training was given them. They performed exceptionally well, and it was an honor to be in their midst as I served my country. And I am convinced without question that the American warrior has no equal and remains second to none. All right, so what about this airborne air combat system that I'm talking about? Now, I'm going to get maybe a little bit technical here, but don't be afraid. I'm not going to get overly technical. I'm going to keep this so everyone can understand it. This is going to be, we're going to use plain language. I'm not going to be employing technical jargon. So this should be understandable for everyone. And hopefully you can enjoy the experience. So the airborne air combat system was not designed for the actual combat conditions encountered. Number two, the system reliability once fielded fell far below expectations. Item three, flight crews were not trained for the actual conditions encountered. Item four, the requirements of maneuver with respect to operator training and systems design was entirely ignored. Ultimately, the military services did not have a fallback plan or a fallback position as they headed pell-mell into the high technology realm and tried to conduct warfare employing high technology. The problem was and is one of critical thinking and imagination. There was very little of it. Now, we can argue all day long about the relative merits of a particular set of technologies, but this misses the point entirely. As with anything new and untried operationally, the prudent thing to do is to have a contingency or backup plan in place with the resources necessary to make it operational. This was not done. All the so-called experts claimed that larger aircraft carrying self-guided missiles was the wave of the future, and gunfighters were a thing of the past. Parenthetically, I was one of the gunfighters. I flew a fighter that had guns. We were also referred to as the last of the gunfighters. Anyway, organization and thinking. We were and are organized for simpler times. But now, as then, now things are considerably more complex. So, we become embedded in the quagmire of complexity, not knowing what to do. Our modern industrial society and modern military demands that we think in different ways, in ways more appropriate for complex environments and complex situations and complex things. So, how do we go about harnessing complexity to make it work for all of us in our lives, particularly here in this particular case, but not exclusively in the lives of air combat warriors? So, complex airborne systems operating in a complex environment, maintained by a complex array of support agencies, in turn supported by a complex array of overhaul and engineering agencies, was what the Naval Air Forces faced. Pretty daunting. Finally, we encountered the ultimate cognitive paradox, and that is this. After a certain point, the more you know, the less you will understand. That is what I call the ultimate cognitive paradox. So at some point in time, when you fill your brain up with all kinds of things, you eventually become overloaded and you start losing your understanding of what is actually going on. Knowing things is not the same thing as comprehending reality. This is the biggest cognitive error that humans make. Okay, maybe I should say that again for emphasis. Okay, I guess I will. All right. It goes like this. Knowing things is not the same as comprehending reality. This is the biggest cognitive error that humans make. If our mental universe is populated by things, we will not become more capable and better problem solvers. We will know more, but be able to do less. Comprehension lies in the ability to go beyond the here and now, utilizing predictive modeling, knowing what a future situation is likely to be from a set of current events, is in fact the key to success. In the realm of aerial combat, all the experts were wrong. One, close-in air combat will quickly be replaced by advanced missiles and radar technology. They were wrong. Item two, maneuver warfare, dogfighting, in other words, is no longer necessary and will not be taught to fighter crews. They were wrong. Item three, energy management in dynamically changing environments is not a required part of the warfare training curriculum. They were wrong. Item four, agility is not necessary in warfare since following tactical procedures is all that is necessary. They were wrong. Item five, adaptability is an unknown attribute and as such it can be ignored or not taught. They were wrong. Item six, technologically superior systems will always be necessary in warfare. They were wrong. Item seven, reliability of high-tech systems will never be a major issue. They were wrong. Item eight, high-tech missile operational performance was so atrocious that the data was never shared with the flight crews. And that was correct, by the way, tragically. Item 9, critical thinking is not necessary in the military because following procedures is all that is needed. They were wrong. We need a huge dose of critical thinking then as well as now. Okay, so we are getting to the point where, all right, so the next section is a little bit more in-depth. It's really quite, I think it's quite amazing. But the next section will be talking about a particular time and particular place. The time or the date is 1968. The place is the Naval Air Station Oceana, which is where I was stationed. And that happens to be in Virginia Beach, Virginia. And we will be talking about that right after this break. Okay, welcome back to Throttle Up. This is a special edition of Throttle Up. It's part two of the discussion of the Vietnam War. So in this section, I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the things that that I was involved with during this this period in our nation's history and during this period of conflict. Okay, the date here is 1968 or thereabouts, and the place is the Naval Air Station Oceana, and that's located in Virginia Beach, Virginia. And we talked about the problem, so let me review that. So the problem was, at that time, the majority of fighter crews that were heading to Vietnam were not adequately trained for the North Vietnam battle space. And this was a major crisis that had developed in naval aviation, and Air Force was also faced with the same crisis. So the combat crews happened to be wholly unprepared for the battle. Now, the idea was that, well, the first idea was this is pretty bad, and we need to do something about it. And so to the great credit of the Navy and to naval aviation in particular, which was my field, we decided that we needed to develop a crash course in realistic aerial combat, and that is because, well, that became our number one priority. And I, and a number of others in my particular age group, we were involved with this on the ground floor. And this, of course, eventually became known as Top Gun. This course of instruction, in order to provide combat-ready air crews trained in close-in aerial combat, required one to adopt new and unusual cognitive operations in order to succeed. First and foremost, it needed to be understood that we were employing other than technical systems, but we happened to believe incorrectly that we were employing technical systems to operate our air vehicles. Ultimately, we were not employing technical systems. What we were doing, we were employing a large-scale, multidimensional cognitive system. So whatever tactical attributes this system had, this airborne system or airborne systems, whatever technical attributes it had, it first and foremost had to be a cognitive system capable of reasoning. In order to be able to employ reason, the system needed to be designed with certain decision aids, okay? And unfortunately, it was not. So we did not have the necessary decision and performance aids in place that were necessary in order for us to optimize this cognitive system. Okay, the next section in our discussion is mission critical. What is mission critical? Of critical importance in any, in anything, really, and in this case, in any air combat engagement, is the recognition of the dynamic four-dimensional region known as the now, here's a technical term that we use, and I don't really like technical terms, but I'm going to throw it out there and then explain what it is. It's pretty simple. The technical term is LAR, which basically means launch availability region. All right, this is the zone in which the airborne missile, and most of these airplanes were missile-carrying airplanes, except for mine. This is where the missile is capable of achieving target tracking. Okay. In the early years of Vietnam Air War, 80%, now this is amazing. Okay, now, so stick with me here. I'm going to throw out some numbers, but they're going to be pretty important to understand what really was the problem. Okay, so 80% of all missiles that were fired during the air war in Vietnam were out of the firing envelope. Let me say that again in a little bit different way. Okay, of all the missiles fired, 80% of those missiles were fired outside of the firing envelope, which made them ineffective in the battle space. So here are some of the numbers, and they were rather depressing. Nevertheless, this is the problem that we were faced with. So the number of missiles fired that were within the missile firing envelope, 20%. Here's another one. The missile mechanical reliability, once the airplane launched from, in my case, once it launched from the carrier and proceeded into the battle space, the missile reliability, as it turned out, was only 10%. In other words, 1 in 10 missiles were mechanically reliable. The third mission critical area was the ability to achieve an advantageous engagement opportunity with respect to the hostile agents. And that was, we're going to say that because the crews that were flying these missions were actually not trained to do that. So we're just going to say that maybe per prior training in other airplanes, maybe some of those crews were capable of achieving advantageous engagement opportunities. So we're gonna put that number at 50%. So we have 20%, 10%, and 50%. Now mathematically, we can combine all of those by using the straightforward mathematics, which is we can actually multiply these percentages or these fractions of these decimals. All right, so if we do that, then our overall operational effectiveness employing this air combat system was 1%. Okay, so we had 1% effectiveness. And this, of course, was a national tragedy, and something had to be done. And so myself, and along with others, that we stepped up and they asked us for some help at the grassroots level, and we agreed to help. Because, I mean, really, what choice did we have? We could have said no, but we kind of knew what needed to be done, and so we did the very best that we could. Now, for an experienced fighter pilot like myself, This, of course, was outrageous, and it remains, in my mind, still outrageous. The air-to-air missile-carrying fighter aircraft cost 10 times as much as their gun-toting predecessors and were headlined as engineering masterpieces, but engineering was not the problem. American engineering and American technology advances were and are the best in the world. So it was not an engineering problem. And most of all, we, in fact, achieved many of our engineering technical objectives. No, technology in engineering was not actually the problem. Now, many people wanted to blame that, but as it turns out, it was a poor problem definition. So what was the problem? The problem is a glaring lack of critical thinking in the way in which we prepare for and conduct warfare. For example, in a recent IT, which is Information Technology Symposium sponsored by MIT, the symposium leadership asserted that most data-driven, aka digital technology-driven business environments will be replaced by temporarily assigned mission teams that quickly form up and solve a particular problem and dissolve once a solution is implemented. So what is happening across the military-industrial landscape is a whole-scale rethinking of how we go about doing our business. That's occurring as we speak, which is a good thing. Now, we are getting to the point that we are no longer interested in strictly following technology vectors, but as any solutions-based enterprise, we are now increasingly interested in finding viable solutions to what is considered to be mission-critical problems. Now, all of this transcends technology. All of this transcends human psychology. All of this is way up there at the much higher level in the abstraction hierarchy. Often, innovative solutions to pressing mission-critical problems are not overly expensive to design and build, and are likewise easy to implement. The mission-level solution to the air combat problem in the 1960s and early 1970s was deceptively simple, albeit not especially easy to implement because we lacked a implementation roadmap. The solution. Okay, here it goes. And looks like I've only got a few more minutes to go, but I'll see if I can finish this before the end of the show. The solution to the overwhelmingly complex air combat problem was to consider any large-scale dynamic system subject to human control to be a cognitive system. Okay, that is really important. All right, here we have, it has never been a technical system. It has never been strictly human psychology. It is a hybrid system which employs cognitive attributes. It's a cognitive system. And as such, a cognitive system needs to be able to reason. All right, that's extremely important. And that's what we discovered. All right, so you can say, well, what did you do? What did you do, Kevin, when you were involved with Top Gun? Well, I began to examine this whole issue of cognitive systems and how do you reason in a complex, highly dynamic environment? Four-dimensional, by the way. It's a four-dimensional dynamic environment. Okay, so the power of reason. Now, we talked about this before. This is the power of reason. So for the cognitive process that we call reason, the question is, reason about what? Okay, Let's say that's a good question. How should reasoning be performed in a dynamic environment consisting of velocities, trajectories, energy states, potential energy, hostility, or another way of saying that are hostile agents, finally, agility and adaptability. In other words, how to reason about maneuver warfare, or more generally, how to reason when it comes to complex dynamic environments. Okay, let me go through the list here, and we have 3 or 4 minutes, all right? So I'm going to try to get through this. If not, we'll continue this next week. All right, so reason code number one, the situation is never, I mean never, what it first appears to be. Okay, that's reason code number one. Reason code number two, it is impossible to understand a complex environment and a complex problem without employing cognitive mechanisms that enable one to do so. You are not born with that capability. You must develop it. It's just like any high-level skill. You are not born with the capability of being a world-class football player or a world-class aviator. You have to learn how to do that. And same thing with thinking. Reason code number three, complex problems cannot be understood if viewed within the context of a particular favored solution. Do not conflate problems with solution. Keep your problem analysis and problem statement pure, pure of contamination. You do not want your cognitive mechanisms to be contaminated by inappropriate things. Reason code number four, complex problems cannot be solved in the here and now. Boy, this is profoundly important. Complex problems cannot and will never be solved in the here and now, but must be projected along a future timeline so as to comprehend an expected situation from a set of current events. Reason code number five, the position of an airborne object and its motion, that is its direction and velocity, also known as velocity vector. I know that's a highfalutin term. It's a technical term that basically means the thing is moving in a particular direction. This cannot be simultaneously understood with certainty. So the position and the velocity vector, they both cannot be understood simultaneously with certainty. So there is a great deal of uncertainty in this environment. Okay, I see that we are now at the end of our show, and we're about done with this. I'm gonna probably finish this up next week because there's a few more things that we need to cover. Anyway, so we're at the end of another Throttle Up. This is a special edition of Throttle Up. It's the Vietnam War Part 2, a thorough discussion of it from a critical thinking standpoint. I would like to thank my audience for participating once again with me in this journey into the new intellectual frontier that we call critical thinking. And thank you, all of you veterans out there. Thank you for your service. And thank you, all of you out there on active duty, and then the Guard and the Reserve, thank you for serving. And now we will end the show and see you all next week.